The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out you are not allowed to criticize. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. It is Tuesday, so it's time for the weekly get together with Dr. Peter Hammond. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
I'm with you. Yes, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And it is 9:54 a.m. here in the UK this Tuesday, April the 9th, 2024, making it 10:54 a.m. over in South Africa. They're one of the few countries that do not change their clocks. What Peter has for us today is a presentation entitled "The Real Story of the Holocaust in Rwanda 30 years ago," and Peter has a book on this very subject, Holocaust in Rwanda, so please go to the links in the show post to find that. I'll probably include a direct link for you. But Peter, where would you like to start us off today with this topic?
Well, 30 years ago, one of the most dreadful campaigns of mass murder was unleashed upon a Tutsi people, a Tutsi tribe in Rwanda. In just 100 days, more people were slaughtered with machetes and clubs than have died from atomic weapons in all of history. I mean, that's something to just think about. More people died at the hands of machetes, a very low-tech genocide in Rwanda in April and May in 1994, than have died in the atomic blasts at Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. I mean, that's quite something to just consider that right there and then. About 800,000 Tutsi Christians were killed, in my estimation. Now, according to the Genocide Museum in Kigali, Rwanda, which I've been to, they say 1.1 million Tutsi died there. Originally, the statistics of the UN was about 500,000, but the UN underestimates when it comes to Christians being killed, overestimates when it comes to others, apparently. But I walked through the killing fields of Rwanda after the event, and I documented. I spent a pretty excruciating few weeks there interviewing survivors and delivering Bibles to people who were guilty of the genocide in the prisons before they were led to the gallows, and was in refugee camps, walked in churches covered in human bodies. I mean, I walked knee-deep in corpses. Sometimes I was waist-high in corpses inside church buildings in Rwanda. It was such a traumatic experience. At the end of it, I was so sick. I mean, physically sick. Each night I'd be hearing screams of people and, you know, it sounded demonic. And it was a horrible experience of being in that situation. And, you know, rats crawling all over the place. The people I was staying with when I was in Kigali were Samaritan's Purse missionaries who were trying to get the Kigali Central Hospital operational again. And the walls were filled with blood. I mean, like the maternity ward was just covered with blood up the walls. The maternity patients, mothers and babies, had been slaughtered by the doctors and nurses who were of the other tribe, the Hutu tribe people. Can you imagine doctors and nurses massacring people in such as in a maternity ward so that the blood was splattered all up the walls, up to even the ceilings? And our people were wading in these Wellington boots and in the gutters and the sewer systems to pull out the dead bodies that were clogging up the whole drainage system. It's hard to imagine there's such a plague of rats. When we were staying at night, every night, you'd have the people sleeping with a machete in one hand and a mag-like torch in the other to bat away the rats. Rats were crawling all over us. I had rats climbing over my face, over body, pillow, everywhere. And, you know, you're batting off rats. Remember this one woman, she is absolutely paranoid about rats, and she chose the bunk bed. In the middle of the night, we heard her screaming away, and it turned out that, well, the rats came through the ceiling onto the top bunk. So she got the biggest amount of rats on her. She didn't think that rats came from the roof. She thought rats came from the floor. So she thought she was safe in the top bunk. In fact, it turned out to be the other way around. They put rat traps around, and every time you heard a rat trap clang, there was a chair throughout the house. And it's hard to just imagine living in a plague of rats and with, you know, who feeding on these massive amounts of corpses, piles of bodies in the streets, piles of bodies in the churches and the hospitals and the schools and the surrounding areas around us. Absolutely staggering. But the real story of the genocide in Rwanda is even worse than that. So at the time, the world media, we're talking about April 1994, the world media attention was focused on South Africa's first one-man, one-vote, multi-party elections. And so when the genocide was launched in 6th of April 1994 up in Rwanda, most African correspondents were in South Africa. Every war correspondent in Africa was certainly in South Africa, and all covering the volatile and pretty violence-ridden elections in South Africa. So in Rwanda, they timed the genocide for the South African elections because they thought everyone's going to be so distracted with what's going on in South Africa, we can get away with anything in Rwanda. And they did. The MRND government, which is a socialist government in Rwanda, meticulously planned and organized the genocide. And China shipped in a million machetes, pangas, these very horrible kinds of broad and long knives, which are used for harvesting in the fields. But in this case, they were there to massacre people. They shipped in a million machetes, red Chinese-made machetes, which were the primary instrument of the Interahamwe mass murderers during the genocide. And the French-trained presidential guard and the army and the gendarmes and the civil administrators were all mobilized to slaughter the Tutsi minority. And they planned that they were aiming to kill 10,000 an hour. And in fact, they came very close to that on occasion. Central to the government strategy, the MRND strategy, was to sow confusion so that nobody would know what's actually happening. So they isolate their victims by imposing a news blackout. The first thing people knew about there's a problem was when all telephone lines were cut. There's one film on the Rwandan genocide called Shooting Dogs, also released in the name of Beyond the Gates. And this chap's in a telephone box and he's talking, suddenly click, 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 click. The line's gone dead. And that was the first sign. The telephones were cut. A nationwide curfew was imposed to keep people in their homes and to prevent them from fleeing. And those who fled to the roadblocks, well, when they produced the ID cards, if the ID indicate they were the wrong tribe, the Tutsi minority, then they got taken to one side and killed by the side of the road, literally. Not normally shot, normally hacked to pieces with a machete. And there would be piles of bodies at these roadblocks. So people were discouraged from traveling on the roads by these selection of the wrong tribe, killing them at the roadblocks. And so people tend to stay in their homes. And then the Interahamwe mass murderers who had been tasked with killing the Tutsi, they had maps and they had addresses and they knew how many Tutsis stayed in which home and where they would be and where the half Tutsis were and people who married to a Tutsi. And so they systematically worked through the homes block by block, room by room until they'd killed them all. And those who tried to flee, they caught at these roadblocks. So that's how this all worked. They sought to isolate the victims and they sought to stifle a flow of news. And the trigger to get this genocide going was a surface-to-air missile was launched against the plane of the president of Rwanda, Habyarimana. He had just come back from peace talks, so to speak, apparently, and the whole plan was although he was one of the architects of the genocide, he was used as a sacrificial lamb by his own side. His own presidential guard was proven to have shot the surface-to-air missile from the presidential palace into the president's plane as he was coming back from outside the country. I think he'd been in Tanzania on peace talks with the other side. And it's the only time in history two presidents have been assassinated simultaneously. There was the president of Burundi and Rwanda in that same plane, and they were killed by their own people. The president's guard shot him down with a French-supplied surface-to-air missile. And that was used as a trigger. They start to scream. Well, they accused the Tutsi of being responsible for killing their own president. And then they portrayed the killings as a spontaneous outbreak of tribal warfare. And confusing the mass killing of defenseless people with the war. There was no war, but that was what they blamed it on. And they played the humanitarian card. The mass murderers called for emergency aid for the victims. And all this was a smokescreen to conceal the state-organized genocide. This was calculated confusion. And many foreign aid workers assisted in this disinformation campaign by contributing ill-informed comments such as, everybody is killing everybody. It's uncontrollable violence. And the Hutus and Tutsis are killing one another again. Well, one side had the weapons and the other side was disarmed. It was not the Hutus and Tutsis killing one another again. It was the Hutus killing the Tutsis. That was what was going on. It was state-sponsored genocide. They first killed the opposition politicians and then the Rwandese journalists and the human rights activists and anyone else who might present an accurate picture of what was going on in this cold-blooded campaign of mass murder. And the MRND government contributed to the strategy of disinformation by portraying the violence as spontaneous rage in response to the assassination of the president, which they had actually done themselves. But this is typical of these kinds of very cynical, hypocritical people. Initially, all the international attention focused on the plight of foreigners. Camera crews, understandably, were only prepared to travel with the international troops. And the international troops' main mission was to evacuate the foreigners. So naturally, this led to a very slanted, very incomplete picture being portrayed to the world. And I remember the initial reports. And the big shock was on the second day, the 7th of April, 10 Belgian soldiers were slaughtered. And they weren't just killed, they were tortured to death, actually. Unbelievably, these Belgian soldiers were convinced to hand their weapons over to the Interahamwe mass murderers in the middle of a genocide. And they handed their weapons over. And for this act of trust or gullibility, they were killed slowly, as in chopping off of hands and feet first, then they worked their way up until... So on live people, they mutilated them. And that, of course, heightened the preoccupation with evacuating foreigners. Unbelievable that soldiers would hand over their weapons in the middle of a genocide, but that's what actually happened. And the killers probably targeted the Belgians precisely to make the evacuation of foreigners a more international priority, and also further encouraged the withdrawal of UNIMIR, the United Nations Assistance Mission for Rwanda. And this strategy of disinformation and terror was spectacularly successful. To this day, most people worldwide do not understand what happened in Rwanda or why it happened. And that's why after my mission to Rwanda, I felt compelled to produce this book, Holocaust in Rwanda, to expose what actually happened in the horrific massacres in homes, hospitals, churches, and on the streets. And the reasons for the systematic slaughter was also often concealed. Holocaust in Rwanda reveals the events that led up to the intense widespread violence, and more importantly, the lessons we need to learn from the genocide in Rwanda. Now, no words can adequately convey the shocking impact of seeing a church building filled with corpses, and nor can any photograph communicate the foreboding silence and the overwhelming smell of death and the continuous buzzing of swarms of flies and insects. But I do put in pictures to try and help to convey something of the slaughter in sanctuaries. More people were killed in churches than any other venue. Churches were the primary locations for the massacres. And the reason is when the genocide began, people fled naturally to places that they thought were sanctuaries. They fled to churches, hospitals, and schools. But that was, in fact, part of the plan from the architects of genocide. They knew people would first flee to the churches, schools, and hospitals. Then they surrounded the hospitals, schools, and churches, and then they attacked them there. And that's when most of the massacres took place. And so one place I went to, Natarama, the church has been left basically as it was on the day of the massacre. So when I went there, not that long afterwards, the bodies were still there decomposing the amidst the pews, and there were skulls on the altar in the front of the church, and you could just see the holes in the walls where holes were made in the brick walls to throw grenades in, and the bodies were lying in every kind of disorder all over the church. About 1,200 people, mostly women and children, were slaughtered within the walls of just this one church building, Natarama, which I've got pictures of. And the pile of skulls that I've got on the cover of my book, Holocaust in Rwanda, I took that picture immediately outside the church building in Nataroma. Now, they say 6,000 people were killed in the surrounding Sunday school classes and around in a bush around the church, Nataroma. 6,000 people, and that was on the 22nd of April, 1994. And survivors, some people hid under corpses to escape, and there are some survivors who lost a leg or an arm or have got massive cuts in their skull, but they lay still under a whole pile of corpses, and a few survived and told us how the Hutu Interahamwe first threw hand grenades into the church building, then moved into a packed congregation with machetes, cutting off limbs and heads. And the church at Nataroma has been left untouched to this day. And you can still see the charred remains of people in some burned out Sunday school classes a few meters away from the church sanctuary. Well, I've spent most of my life serving persecuted Christians, and I grew up amidst the war in Rhodesia, and I served in the South African Defence Force. I've been in the war in Angola and Southwest Africa. I've been involved in 8 wars as a missionary, and this was definitely the worst that I ever saw in my whole life. Absolutely staggering. We were dealing with crawling insects, myriads of flying, crawling, biting insects, ever-present rats, complicated everything. And just in the Kigali Central Hospital, 7,000 people had been killed. And you can just imagine the situation in an area where patients were killed by psychiatrists, obstetricians, surgeons, gynecologists, dentists, nurses. They're all involved in murdering their own patients and their fellow doctors and nurses on the base of tribe. And the second largest place of massacres was the schools. And many school teachers were involved in the killing of their fellow students and teachers. And so, again, it was tribal. Hutu mass murderers, Tutsi victims. And again, what most people have missed is the fact that Tutsi were overwhelmingly Protestant, while the Hutu were mostly into witchcraft or syncretistic with Catholic and witchcraft. But it wasn't only Catholics and witchcraft adherents doing some of the massacres. There were Seventh-day Adventists, there were Baptists, there were people of a variety, Methodists, there were a variety of other denominations, even Anglicans involved in the massacres as well, not just as victims, but as perpetrators as well, all on tribal lines. And when it got down to it, whether a person was Hutu or Tutsi made all the difference. And the Hutus of Rwanda, I said at the time, have AIDS, an acquired integrity deficiency syndrome. It seems a lot of our Christians around the world have acquired integrity deficiency syndrome. And there was a lot of cowards who knew that this was wrong, but they didn't do anything to actually help. So when I walked through the killing fields of Rwanda, a lot of thoughts rushed through my mind. Here I could see clearly the depravity of man. There are those who believe in the goodness of man. Well, the Reformed faith believes in the depravity of man, that people are basically evil. And here we could see the total failure of man's attempted solutions. If the United Nations really was meant to be any kind of answer to the complex problems created by man's rebellion against our Creator and his laws, here we can see that, in fact, the United Nations and the humanist agenda is not the solution, they're actually a key part of the problem. Contrary to what a lot of humanists claim, man is not basically good, nor is man evolving and improving. Mankind has fallen into sin, and man is intrinsically evil. And we need strict laws and checks and balances and decentralization and armed citizens to restrain the evil within men's hearts. Rwanda was a gun-free zone. Now, the fact is, armed citizens can save lives, but unarmed citizens just become helpless victims. A free people need to be armed. And that's, in fact, required in Britain's common law, Magna Carta, Dooms of King Alfred, the English Bill of Rights of 1689, all require free people have the right to keep and bear arms. And in the case of the 1689 English Bill of Rights, the right to keep firearms was also clearly entrenched. The American Bill of Rights is based on the earlier English Magna Carta, the Dooms of King Alfred, the Laws of Canute, and of course the 1689 Bill of Rights, which William and Mary endorsed. A government which fears its people is itself to be feared. No government should have a monopoly of force or weaponry. And basically, a disarmed people can easily be exploited and oppressed. If a government doesn't trust its citizens with weapons, how can those citizens trust their government with power? So as I was overwhelmed by the sights and the sounds and the smells of death all around the church, I knelt down outside the Nataroma congregation amidst the remains of the martyrs on the church steps, and I prayed the martyr's prayer of Revelation 6. How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And I prayed for God to judge the wicked, to comfort the relatives of the victims, and prayed for God to have mercy on all of us. Then I praised God for the reality of the resurrection, for his victory over death, because Jesus Christ is the resurrection and the death. He is the resurrection and the life. His church is unshakable, untakeable, unstoppable, unbeatable. But I came back from Rwanda very sick, and my mother, being a nurse, organized me to go to some of the best doctors, and I had all kinds of tests, and they took all kinds of vials of blood for me, and after batteries of tests, the result came back virus tropical, which my mother said means they don't have a clue. And I was sick for quite a while after coming back from Rwanda. I wonder how much of that was physical, how much was spiritual. It certainly had physical symptoms, but it probably was just being around such absolute evil. Somebody made the comment that hell must be empty of demons because all the demons seem to be right here in Rwanda. And the cemetery at Nyanza was another place that I visited. And this cemetery contained the graves of 3,500 people who were massacred after being abandoned in a schoolyard by the UN peacekeepers. And this incident was dramatized in the film Shooting Dogs, which was also released as Beyond the Gates. Now, the title's pretty disgusting, Shooting Dogs, but it comes from the policy of the UN forces that they weren't allowed to shoot the people doing the massacres, but they were to shoot the dogs that ate the bodies of the victims of the massacres. And that insanity of the law, rules of engagement by Kofi Annan is what basically led to the title Shooting Dogs, but most people hated the title so much they re-released the film as Beyond the Gates. Because what happened at the schoolyard at the ETO school was where the UN had a refugee camp. The UN decided to abandon the people, but instead of telling them, we're going to abandon you, they organized a meal in the hall, and while everyone was busy with the meal, they just quietly drove out the gates. And as they drove out, there was all these mass murderers, the Interahamwe, dancing, singing with their machetes and their clubs. And as the UN drove out, in came the mass murderers, and they slaughtered these poor people who had no warning that they were being betrayed by the UN. And so that's the subject of the Beyond the Gates or Shooting Dogs film, which is much better than the Hotel Rwanda. Hotel Rwanda film was filmed in South Africa, and only Americans and South Africans appear in the film. There's no Rwandese in the whole film. Whereas Shooting Dogs is filmed in Rwanda at the actual sites, and all the people playing Rwandese are Rwandese. And so the Shooting Dogs film, which is a British production, was far more accurate and far more true to the reality of what happened, whereas Hotel Rwanda was very much a slick Hollywood production, which sadly missed most of the real issues. Now, every night in Rwanda, I could hear ear-piercing screams of people who were plainly terrified, if not demon-possessed. And I was sick, literally, body, mind, and spirit, after being in Rwanda, ministering to all these people. The Holocaust Rwanda book that I wrote is unique in that it examines the disgraceful conduct of liberal church leaders, World Council Church leaders, and gun control, which prepared the way, and the media manipulation. Rwanda was a gun-free zone, and the mass murderers successfully manipulated and abused the media to vilify the targeted Tutsis and to mobilize masses of Hutus to kill their neighbors and to feel good about it. The scandalous role of the French government is also exposed. The French government provided assistance, training, and weapons to the mass murderers, and the French military expedition actually helped before, during, and after the fact, the genocide. Despite the fact that France has signed an anti-genocide treaty, they fully participated in the genocide by providing all the weapons and training for the mass murderers. And when the mass murderers started to lose, because the Tutsi had been victims of massacres over the years too, you know, a few thousand here and a few thousand there. Many Tutsi had fled across the border into neighboring Uganda, which of course is mostly English-speaking. And so the Tutsi had developed more of an English-speaking culture because they were refugees in an English-speaking country. And the Tutsi were still French-speaking. Now, Rwanda and Burundi used to be part of German East Africa, Tanzania. And after the First World War, the Versailles Treaty handed them over to Belgium, which is why they were speaking French. And the Belgians left the traditional king structures, the traditional chiefs in power. So basically the Tutsi, who were the minority, but they were more educated, they were more literate, they were more prosperous. They were the cattle farmers, and they also tend to be the royal family. So the Tutsi were still basically running the country under Belgian supervision. And there was a lot of resentment at that by the socialists when the socialists planned the revolutions after 1960 and 62, when the Belgians withdrew and abandoned the Congo and then Burundi and Rwanda to their fate during the Cold War. The socialists, sponsored by the Soviet Union and Red China, particularly dug in and got the Hutu majority, who was mostly the farmers, as in the peasants who tilled the soil, to resent the cattle farming Tutsi and the more literate, more Protestant leaders, who were the Tutsi, who's also taller, more angular, sharper features. And they started to put them as the ones to blame, you know, the bourgeois, the rulers. And so they tried class warfare, which mingled with tribal warfare, with witchcraft, even worse, and basically demonized the Tutsi tribe. And so the socialists built up such resentment that from the very beginning of the independence of Rwanda, the Tutsi were being targeted for massacres. So as when these major massacres, the genocide of 1994, occurred, many of the Tutsi who were in refugee camps in Uganda determined, we've got to do something. We can't stand by and allow our relatives across the border to all be murdered. So they decided to mobilize. Burundi's Patriotic Front came across the border to try and stop the genocide. And what chance did they have? The Tutsi were about 15% of the population at that stage, and the Hutus were over 80%. So, you know, you would look at this and say they had no chance. Plus, the Hutus had the support of France. And so the French government's giving them military aid and financial aid and everything else. What chance did these rebels, the Rwandese Patriotic Front of Tutsi exiles, what chance did they have? But interestingly, wherever they attacked, they won. And whenever the little David attacked Goliath, Goliath fled. And so the MRND government just fled time and again wherever the Rwandese Patriotic Front attacked them. And so the situation got to such a dire situation that France sent in their paratroopers and the French Foreign Legion in what they called Operation Turquoise. And Operation Turquoise was not to stop the genocide, it was to help the architects of genocide escape. Operation Turquoise created a safe cordon, an area of safety where the mass murderers could flee to. And then the French provided a screen of protection to allow their Hutu allies to escape into neighboring Congo, what was then called Zaire, to flee from justice at the hands of the survivors of the genocide. And so the French government were aiding before, during, and after the genocide. And many of the architects of mass murders are living now in France or Canada, interestingly enough. So much for the justice of Justin Trudeau and Macron's France and Canada. They are protecting people guilty of genocide, war crimes, to put it in the nicest way, crimes against humanity, to use their terminology. And when the French foreign minister was asked, why are you helping the MRND Hutu mass murderers? His answer was, we are holding the line for Francophone Africa against Anglophone Africa. Translation, the Tutsi speak English and the Hutu speak French. So, okay, they're mass murderers, but they're French-speaking mass murderers. So obviously they should be protected. And that was the French government's defense then and now. That is why people guilty of crimes against humanity, terrorism, mass murders, genocide, are being protected in France and Canada to this day, not being extradited back to Rwanda, despite requests for this to be done. And they've got mass murderers who were high in the church and high in government who are responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of people. And they will not release them because they're French-speaking. And therefore, what they did was apparently justified. To show you how much the people of Rwanda hate the French government and the United Nations, after the genocide, Rwanda changed their national language from French to English, because nothing could hurt France more than to lose another Francophone African country. And so, in fact, they've not only left the Francophone Economic Union, they've joined the Commonwealth, one of only two countries that never were part of the British Empire Commonwealth that belong to the Commonwealth today, Mozambique being the other one. So that's pretty intriguing right there. So on many occasions, priests, nuns, and ministers were directly involved in a genocide, and even heads of denominations cooperated in Tahambwe, betraying their Tutsi congregations and co-workers into the hands of these mass murderers. And so in my book, I reveal the role of these Christian traitors, these bloodstained bishops, these murderous ministers of Rwanda. They're an indictment upon our theological seminaries and our church councils. Those who do not wholeheartedly love the Lord Jesus Christ and his word are not qualified to be spiritual leaders. And the Rwandan Holocaust exposes the emptiness of the superficial, self-centered, easy believism, which all too often masquerades as the gospel. Compromise and cowardice helped cause the catastrophe in Rwanda. And so, most importantly, the Holocaust in Rwanda book also looks at some of the reasons which and lessons that need to be learned in order to ensure that such atrocities do not reoccur. And far more important than the concerns for retribution is the urge and need to lay foundations for the future that will prevent such nationwide oppression from ever occurring again. And so the last chapter in my book are on biblical principles which are not only important for Rwanda, but for every society which values life and liberty. Rwanda was a gun-free zone. Tyrants preferred disarmed citizens. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Armed citizens save lives. Centralization can be easily abused by tyrants. We need decentralization. And these are key principles. It's also significant for me living in South Africa because we've got political parties in our country who are calling for a Rwandan-type genocide on whites and coloureds or mixed-race people in South Africa, and including Indians too. So we've got some black racists like Julius Malemba of the EFF, which they call the Economic Freedom Fighters. I call them the Everything for Free Party. So these political parties literally mobilize stadiums of their supporters, all dressed in red with red berets, with the red star, and they're pounding their feet on the ground, shouting, kill, 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 shoot the Boer, shoot the farmer, shoot to kill, shoot to kill, ba, 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 ba. And you see tens of thousands of these red-clad Marxists in Julius Malema's EFF filling stadiums, just chanting out this zombie dance with these hate speech kind of songs, calling for, you know, bring me my machine gun and let's kill a white man, kill a farmer and kill a Boer. That's the kind of attitude we've got with many. And I was at a public meeting at a local club in Cape Town called the Kelvin Grove some years ago. And there was an ANC member of parliament. And this was before Nelson Mandela died. But he was saying, when Nelson Mandela dies, we will kill you whites like flies. That was a slogan. And I was at this meeting and I heard this from this man. And so sitting there, I said to him, you mean something like Rwanda? And he said, yes, exactly like Rwanda. And then I said, did you notice how that ended? And he stopped for a moment, looked over at me, and he looked a bit confused. So I had to remind him. I said, because David beat Goliath, the Tutsi minority who were the victims became the victors. Today, the Tutsi run Rwanda and nobody complains about the fact that it's a minority government because the majority completely destroyed their credibility in the eyes of the world by engaging in such genocidal practices against their minority neighbors. And he hesitated for a bit longer and I said, you know, the Rwandan Tutsis have no great military tradition, but the Boers of South Africa have a tremendous military tradition. We took on the British Empire in the Anglo-Boer War and defeat them in the First Anglo-Boer War and caused them tremendous suffering in the Second Anglo-Boer War. And we've got a great military tradition, First, Second World War, Malayan conflict, Korean War, and of course fighting in Angola. And the South African Army defeated the Cubans in Angola, the elite, that presidential guard that Fidel Castro could send over in the battles of Lomba River, and reminded him of some of our military accomplishments. Said, bear in mind, there are 650,000 military veterans living in South Africa who've actually fought a war and won. And if you start a genocide against whites in South Africa, there will be such a backlash, more than anyone ever saw in Rwanda. And there's South Africans who are working all over the world as military contractors, fighting for the Americans in Iraq and Afghanistan and for the British in Middle East. And we've got many South African military veterans who are actually mercenaries around the world who would come back and they'd bring some of their friends as well. And In fact, I've been ministering in Australia and had somebody come up to me and say, you know, he's never been to South Africa, but he said, if you get into trouble in South Africa, I will come over and I'll volunteer and fight there. And I've met people in many parts of the world who've said the same thing. We've got many military trained and experienced people all over the world who would come back if there was an attack on our people in South Africa. So I don't think they realize how they're playing with such fire, because we do have people in South Africa talking about they want to do ethnic cleansing, wiping out of all whites, Indians, and coloureds. Africa for the Africans, South Africa for the blacks only, kill all the other races. And we've got these people talking about that kind of genocidal mentality. We've got the Black First, Land First group, and others who are even more radical in the EFF. And with talks about genocide in South Africa echoing what happened in Rwandan genocide, I think it's important that people learn the lessons and bear in mind that right now Rwanda is one of the best run, cleanest, neatest, most efficient countries in Africa. And in fact, it's one of the easiest countries in the whole of Africa to start a business in. Not even one page of paperwork to open up business. The government's made it very easy for free enterprise and so on. And traveling around Rwanda, we found an extraordinary contrast between what it was like in 1994 to what it's like these days. And I think that should also be a warning to those who've got these genocidal plans, because things can change and boomerang back in a way that they never predicted. There's another film out on Rwanda and book that I would recommend, and that's Shake Hands with the Devil. Now, Canadian General Romeo Dallaire was the commander of the United Nations mission to Rwanda, or UNIMIR. And his book, which I've read, which has also been turned into a dramatic film, Shake Hands with the Devil, is quite extraordinary. Here's one key quote. "I know that there's a God," says General Romeo Dallaire, "because in Rwanda I shook hands with the devil. I've seen him, I've smelt him, I've touched him. I know the devil exists, therefore I know there is a God." Now, Shake Hands with the Devil is an extraordinary document because it's from someone who really believed in the UN, who believed the UN was there for good, that the UN was going to actually help people. Interestingly, his subtitle for his book, Shake Hands with the Devil, is The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. Not the failure of the United Nations in Rwanda, the failure of humanity. As the people of Rwanda somberly reflect on 30 years ago when the Holocaust was unleashed upon them, there's some compelling questions which demand answers. How could those dreadful mass murders take place within sight and sound of the United Nations peacekeepers without the so-called international community doing anything to stop it? And the question is, could the Holocaust in Rwanda have been prevented? And General Romeo Dallaire's answers an unequivocal yes, they could have prevented the genocide in Rwanda. And did the United Nations leadership know of the coming genocide? And General Romeo Dallaire documents, yes, they did. He kept them fully alert to the stockpiling of weapons, the million machetes that came in from Red China. He kept Secretary General Boutros-Ghali, who used to be Egyptian foreign minister and had facilitated large arms sales from Egypt to the MRND dictatorship in Rwanda prior to the genocide. And Kofi Annan, who was head of the Security Council, he was well informed. And the American president at the time, Bill Clinton, and Warren Christopher, the American Secretary of State, fully aware of everything that was going on. And they not only did nothing to prevent it, they did everything to stop General Dallaire doing his job to protect the people of Rwanda. He was continually told, you're a peacekeeper, not a peacemaker. And he was told not to get involved. And General Romeo Dallaire had the lists and the plans ahead of time passed on to him that genocide was being planned, that they were planning to kill 10,000 people an hour, all the planning of how they were going to go about it. And he was planning to raid the warehouse where the million machetes were stockpiled before they were being distributed. And he was told by Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the UN, cease and desist, stop, do not get involved. And he said he didn't think he needed permission. He thought that's within his mandate as a peacekeeper. But he was told to stop interfering at that point. And all the massacres that happened thereafter was as a result of Kofi Annan's policies. And interestingly, Kofi Annan, 10 years after the massacres, finally was prevailed upon by the people of Rwanda to give an apology. And his apology was in these words, the world failed you. Not I failed you, not the United Nations failed you, the world failed you. How's that for not taking personal responsibility. Well, not only that, but General Dallaire documents how Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana was assassinated by a French heat-seeking missile fired by his own presidential guard on the 6th of April, and this was the pretext to launch the well-prepared genocide of the mostly Protestant Tutsi, and how the government forces set up a dense network of roadblocks and mobilized inter-Harambee mobs of civilians to systematically go house to house and massacre the Tutsis. And of course, at the roadblocks, those identified as the Tutsi minority were pulled out and hacked to death on the spot. And out of a total population of 7.3 million, 84% were Hutu, 15% Tutsi, 1% Twa. And they calculated at least, well, the United Nations calculated 800,000 killed. The African Rights calculated 750,000 murdered. The present government of Rwanda and the Holocaust Museum, Kigali, calculates 1.171 million killed. That's 1,171,000 victims, 90% of which were Tutsi. The rest would have been Hutus who were friends with Tutsis or married to Tutsis and so on. And the Genocide Museum, Kigali, which I visited, calculates that during the 100 days of the genocide, an average of 10,000 were murdered every day. Now, the original plan had been 10,000 to be murdered every hour. 400 were murdered every hour and 7 every minute. And as a result of the genocide, 400,000 children were orphaned as a result. Now, the 2005 film Shooting Dogs was released in America as Beyond the Gates, and it focused on the United Nations abandoning the Ecole Technique Officielle, or the ETO school in Kigali. And this is based on the eyewitness experience of the BBC news producer David Belton, who worked in Rwanda during the genocide. And Belton was one of the film's co-writers and one of its producers. And unlike Hotel Rwanda, which was entirely filmed in South Africa using American and South African actors, Beyond the Gates was actually shot at the original locations of the scenes it portrays, and most of the actors in the film were Rwandese survivors of the massacres. And the film's title, Shooting Dogs, refers to that ridiculous policy of the UN that they were allowed to shoot the stray dogs who were scavenging the bodies of the dead, but they were not allowed to shoot the Hutu mass murderers who were causing the deaths in the first place. And so this is just symptomatic of the madness of the situation and the insanity of the United Nations rules of engagement. General Dallaire had sent faxes to the United Nations headquarters in January 1994 detailing the planned anti-Tutsi genocide. He'd identified the locations of the illegal arms caches, the orders to register all Tutsi in Kigali, and the Inter-Harambee plan to use these very lists to exterminate them all. Well, a high-level informant informed the general of the exact details of the Inter-Harambee plans, including the fact that they believed they could kill 1,000 every 20 minutes. And when the UN abandoned the technical school filled with thousands of Tutsi refugees, the Hutu Inter-Harambee slaughtered them all. And the administrative head of UNIMO, the former Cameroonian foreign minister, Jacques Roger Boubou, maintained very close ties with the militant Hutu elite and on every side undermined and thwarted General Dallaire's efforts to prevent the genocide. So this administrative head of UNIMO, who is a Cameroonian foreign minister, he was one of the villains who assisted and was an accessory to mass murder before, during, and after. The United States President Bill Clinton did everything he could to undermine every effort by General Dallaire and the UNIMO in Rwanda to save lives. And the Clinton's administration policy was summarized as, let's withdraw altogether, let's get out of Rwanda, and let's leave it to its fate. Now, the United States ambassador to the UN at the time, Madeleine Albright, or Madeleine Not-So-Bright, she consistently lobbied for a withdrawal of UNIMO forces. And from the earliest in April 1994, as she was wanting to abandon all refugees who had sought sanctuary with the UN and leave them to the fate of the Inter-Harambee. And the U.S. Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, consistently argued against using the term genocide until the 21st of May. And even then, U.S. officials waited another 3 weeks before allowing that term genocide to be used, because they kept arguing that no one has the right to use the term genocide except Jews, and that it's unacceptable to speak about genocide in any other context like Rwanda, even though they were killing thousands of people, intending to wipe out the entire population of the Tutsi, throwing them on literally pits of burning tires and things like this, literally throwing people alive into burning pits, and yet they couldn't use the word Holocaust or genocide. and the US blocked any action simply because of the use of that term. And the Czech government was complaining about the US government undermining every attempt of the Security Council to try and save lives. And then when the US government was asked to block or jam the extremist RTLM radio broadcasts, which were coordinating the genocide, they cited the cost and concern with international law. In the middle of a genocide, they're saying, we don't know that we've got the right to jam these frequencies that might interfere with international law and could cost too much. So General Dallier reveals all this, and he also reveals that President Clinton and his cabinet were made aware of this final solution to exterminate all Tutsis long before the massacres even began. And every request from General Dallier was frustrated. His peacekeepers did not receive the food, the fuel, the weapons, the equipment, the ammunition, not even armored personnel carriers they requested. And UN procrastination led to intense suffering, unnecessary deaths, starvation at the UN bases, which were meant to be sanctuaries for refugees fleeing the killing. I went to the actual stadium in Kigali where the UN had a refugee camp and had thousands, well over 10,000 refugees there, staying in the stadium who had fled there for protection. And every day, Inter Hamburg came to the UN gates, which I've been at, and gave them a list of people they wanted, school teachers, journalists, and so on. And the UN went to the trouble of finding those people, bring them to the gates, and they were hacked to death within sight of the UN guards in front of the UN base near the Kigali football stadium. And the next day, the Inter Hamburg came with another list, more journalists, teachers, and pastors, and so on. And the UN brought them out, and then they got killed. And then the next day, they came with another list, and the UN went to trouble to find those people, bring them to the gate. So this has not been depicted in any film, but it should be, because this is the reality of the United Nations. On the 22nd of June, as the Tutsi-led Rwandese Patriotic Front turned the tide and began to liberate the country, sending the Hutu and Inter Hamburg fleeing, the French launched Operation Turquoise, creating a safe zone into which Hutu military and militia and the Inter Hamburg mass murderers could flee and receive protection behind the French military screen. So this French Operation Turquoise effectively enabled the genocidaries to escape from the Rwandese Patriotic Front and flee into neighboring Zaire, what we now call the Congo, where they received generous quantities of foreign aid and caused more massacres, which led to the Great Lakes War of 1996, which continued to 1997, in which 12 African nations became involved in this war. Some called it Africa's World War. Millions died as a result, multiplied millions, possibly 6 or 7 million or more died in the Great Lakes War. That came as a direct result of Operation Turquoise bringing these genocidal maniacs into Zaire, who were then able to spawn much greater wars as a result, all into tribal genocide. So General Dallier reported France supplied weapons and ammunition, the MRND Hutu dictatorship, and their military during the height of the genocide. They came in with planes that could have brought aid for the peacekeepers, but instead they were bringing aid not for the peacekeepers or the refugees or the victims of the violence, but for the people doing the mass murders. And the findings of the Rwandese Justice Commission, which was released in 2008, accused 32 senior French military political officials of being accessories to the genocide, including President François Mitterrand and General Secretary Hubert Verdun and the then Prime Minister Edouard Balladur and the Foreign Minister Alain Juppé and his chief aide Dominique de Villepin. And as a result of the Rwandese Justice Ministry's commission on the involvement of France in the genocide, the Rwandese government shut down the French institutions in and around Kigali, including their schools, their cultural organizations, and the language of instruction in Rwandese schools was switched from French to English. And so Rwanda is one of only two members of the British Commonwealth that were not formerly British colonies or protectorates. Well, I can never forget the stench of death as I walked knee-deep and waist-high amidst corpses in the church in Rwanda, and the plague of rats and rats climbing all over me and seeing rats feasting off bodies, millions of crawling, flying insects, suffocating odor of death. This isn't something you can easily recover from or forget. I delivered over 100 Bibles in Kinyi, Rwanda, and French to pastors and prisoners around Rwanda, and took painful interviews with the survivors to document what happened and why. And this has led to producing two editions of Holocaust in Rwanda, subtitled The Roles of Gun Control, Media Manipulation, Liberal Church Leaders and the United Nations. In two editions were produced in English. Another edition was produced in French. And I actually went to Paris to help launch this book. And I think it's so important that people in France know what their government has been doing. And it's absolutely staggering how many of the people involved in the massacres were ostensible Christians, actual Judases. And, you know, even Jesus had his Judas, and I'm afraid we still got Judases around today. But moral cowardice helped cause this catastrophe. And so we should make a stand against the superficial, self-centered, easy believism, which too often masquerades as the gospel. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore, the wrath of the Lord is upon you. We read in 2 Chronicles 19, verse 2. But it's good to notice that the genocide ultimately failed. The victims did become the victors, and the Tutsi minority surprised everyone by fighting back and regaining control over the whole country. Today, Rwanda is one of the best-run and most open to free enterprise countries in the whole of Africa. Psalm 127 says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain." And there is much for us to learn from these events of 1994. And they're also very relevant in the light of those talking about a second phase of the revolution in South Africa, threatening to exterminate the white minority here. "But blessed be the Lord my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle. He is my loving kindness and my fortress, my high tower and my deliverer, my shield and the one in whom I take refuge." So back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Obviously, very sad events, almost 30 years to the day. It started on the 6th of April, so that was 1994, so that was back in on the weekend, Saturday, I believe was the 6th of April. We're going out on the 9th of April. There was, you didn't touch upon a story that I always remember associated with this, is when you presented your book to someone in a Holocaust museum. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was a guest of General Ben Parton, U.S. Air Force retired scientist who designed a lot of precision-guided weapons. Well, General Parton said to me one day when I was visiting him, I stayed more in his home, spent more time with him probably any other American home in my times in America. He's in Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. So General Parton one day said to me, "Peter, I want to take you to the Holocaust Museum in downtown Washington." So, you know, trusting him, I thought he's got to have a reason for this. So he took me along there, and I asked for the director of the museum and was shown up a few flights of stairs to his office. And a very nice big building, I must say, apparently built by American taxpayers' money. And so I introduced myself as a missionary to persecuted Christians, and I presented him a copy of my Holocaust Rwanda book, and I had some pictures, including a flash drive, which had, and actually on a disc too, a whole lot of high-quality, full-size pictures of Holocaust in Rwanda. You know, I had piles of skulls, a lot of great pictures of churches filled with corpses and other piles of machetes. So I offered on a disc a whole lot of these pictures that were in the book for the Holocaust Museum. And the director seemed a bit confused, and he said, "Why are you giving this to me?" I said, "Well, isn't this the Holocaust Museum?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, surely you'd be interested in having exhibits on this too." And he, at this point, ordered me out of the place and started accusing me of being anti-Semitic and racist. I couldn't see how it could be that, considering, you know, we're concerned about black Christians who were slaughtered in horrific numbers in Rwanda. And he got security to start escorting me out. But as I was being escorted out, I saw, and I'm sorry, I wasn't able to get a picture because I was being sort of hustled with an arm on, with people on each arm pulling me along. And on the wall, it had a big sign saying, "Anti-Semitism began with the birth of Jesus Christ." Well, that's pretty disgusting. But I saw something similar to that when I went to London, 2014, at the 100th anniversary of the First World War, went to the Imperial War Museum, and they had an exhibit there. There's a Holocaust Museum supplement section in the Imperial War Museum where they claimed verbally and in writing, just in case you couldn't read, they had it verbally as well, "Anti-Semitism began with Martin Luther and the Reformation." So, I mean, that's pretty bad, blaming the Back to the Bible Protestant Reformation for anti-Semitism, and the man who gave us the Bible available in our own languages and brought back justification by faith and the key elements of the Bible, of the Reformation. But the one in Washington seemed the most anti-Christian of all. Anti-Semitism began with the birth of Jesus Christ. I mean, how blasphemous and ridiculous is that?
Thank you, Peter. That's a very interesting and revealing tale when you look at what is going on today and the people that are being targeted today. Only on Sunday I presented your persecution of Christians worldwide continues, and it is getting worse as the traditional Christian message that I broadcast, for those of you who haven't heard, they're generally all written by Peter and I read them, and they're quite short and they go out every Sunday, so please go to achshow.com and avail yourself of those. The last 3 or 4 weeks should be up on the website. Before we go, Peter, could you please let the audience know, I will say I've put a link in the post for the show to your Holocaust in Rwanda book on your christianlibertybooks.co.za website. I don't believe it's one of the ones on Lulu yet, but if there are any other links, please let me know and I'll include those. But can you please let the audience know where they can find your work and how they can contact you?
Yes, now I do have a chapter on the Holocaust in Rwanda in my Frontline Behind Enemy Lines for Christ book, and that one, of course, is available by Lulu and also on Smashwords as an ebook. I think the Holocaust in Rwanda book is available as an ebook too, though, on Smashwords. But all that, those links should be on christianlibertybooks.co.za. So www.christianlibertybooks.co.za. And my personal email, peter@frontline.org.za. I'm planning to come to America and Britain late April, early May. I'll be in Britain late May. And if anyone's interested in organizing any meetings for me, they can be home meetings, school meetings, whichever, radio interviews, I'll be very glad to receive that. If people want to communicate with me, peter@frontline.org.za. We're also on Facebook page, and I've put on out some videos also on the Holocaust in Rwanda on our Facebook page and website, which enable people to see some of what I saw. I try to document it in pictures because it's very hard for people to believe what one's saying. One needs to give photographic evidence. But thank you very much, Andrew, back to you.
Thank you so much, Peter. And Peter's email address is also in the post for this show. So if you didn't catch it, just go to achshow.com and click any of Peter's shows with me. You will see on the page there. And when you open up the post, you will find his email address in the post for the show, whichever one of his you open up. You just need to copy and paste that into your email that you use and then whisk something over to Peter. It is... Peter hasn't actually been to America or the UK for many years, so it is an opportunity. If you would like to sort something out and work with Peter, then I hope that we can get you together in the US or the UK. So that being said, I want to thank Peter so much for joining us for a presentation today entitled The Real Story of the Holocaust in Rwanda 30 Years Ago. I want to thank all of you for listening. I'll be back with you all on Saturday, and until then, folks, have a wonderful week, and bye for now.